this disgraceful normalization deal.
Actually, it's quite disgusting that the Moroccan regime has established ties initially covertly with the Zionist entity and now continues to do so in a public and open fashion, as if there is no shame that is to be held in the hearts of these officials that they are coalescing and moving around and connecting with and acting in tandem with the Zionist entity, which practices apartheid, which practices colonialism, and is a scourge to the world. The answer to the people of Morocco is to protest, to organize, and continue their principles of mobilization. Yes, the struggle in the Western Sahara is one part, but the other aspect is that you have to support these types of protests to change foreign policy. These are the answers. It's organization, it's protest and consistency.
Journalists in Morocco have also categorically rejected media normalization with Israel, describing it as a crime against Palestinians, Moroccans and humanity. Now, the statement came after the Israeli regime's I-24 news channel announced the opening of two offices in the country. Now, what exactly is the Israeli regime media pursuing in Morocco by establishing offices there?
I think the indication comes very clearly from an interview that was held with Major General Yossi Kupervaser, who was the former head of Israeli Defense Force Research and Development. And he's repeated this, and this has been repeated by other officials as well, that the issue is narrative war. The biggest problem for Israel, apart from military campaigns by the resistance and the defeats that they suffer at the hands of the resistance, is the global pressure that develops and continues to pursue Israel after the military operations. We have seen in the recent days there was an operation in Gaza, and this was a preemptive strike by Israel that resulted in massive inconvenience and damage to the Zionist entity. We had places like Sderot being completely evacuated, the people being moved to Haifa. You had Beersheba coming under attack, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Tel Aviv. Yes, that's the one part. Now, the bigger problem is that Israel and its only principle is that of deterrence capacity. It is the establishing principle of Israel that they have to act in a manner that is tandem with hooliganism.
The monarchy in Morocco and the Israeli regime are concerned with Algeria's growing importance and influence in Africa and the West Asia region. Morocco has its long, well-known disputes with Algeria over the Western Sahara issue, while the Israeli regime is very annoyed by the extensive Algerian efforts over the past 2 years in Africa to prevent it from joining the African Union as an observer. The Algerian president has also categorically rejected the normalization of ties with Israel.
And now our last question. Now, how have ties with the Israeli regime affected Morocco's relations with its neighbor Algeria?
There has been accusations against Algeria that they have fully supported the Polisario Front within Western Sahara. There have been issues there as well. And there have been sanctions that were placed between the countries. There was limiting of trade, etc., with the exclusion of gas. So the relationship recently and the collapse thereof has been attributed to Israel and Morocco establishing these open ties. What was also problematic was the meeting that I referred to in August of last year, 2021, by the then foreign minister, Yair Lapid, now the prime minister. And he made certain very damning allegations that were unsubstantiated, that Algeria is playing a role of destabilization within the region. His greatest fear was the closening relationship between Algeria and Iran, and Iran is the greatest exporter of terrorism, etc. The general Israeli narrative is nothing new. However, these types of comments and statements by Israeli leaders in Morocco would naturally sour relations between Algeria and Morocco. Yes, there's a backdrop of bigger issues and other issues. However, this does contribute to the increasing split between the two nations.
Well, our guest there says that the Israeli regime is pursuing an evil agenda of increasing tensions between Morocco and Algeria. Thank you very much, Zakir Ahmed, for your insight. We now take a short break before our next segment, which is on the uprising against United Nations troops in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us.
An uprising against UN troops in Democratic Republic of Congo.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Tensions have continued to rise in the restive east of the Democratic Republic of Congo after weeks of deadly protests against UN peacekeepers. 36 people, including four UN peacekeepers, died recently as hundreds of angry protesters attacked UN buildings in several cities in eastern frontier provinces.
This is not the first time protests have broken out against UN peacekeepers in eastern Congo. However, these recent events have brought to the surface the persistent challenge facing the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, MONUSCO. The United Nations mission in the Congo has long suffered a crisis of confidence among local communities. It has been accused of failing to protect civilians and improve security in the region, despite a presence spanning more than two decades.
A Congolese citizen explains here reasons for their resentment towards the UN peacekeepers in this mineral-rich Central African country.
We've been watching the UN mission since the start. They have the logistical capacity they need. What are they doing with that? This is why we need to kick them out.
Now to discuss the tensions between the people of DR Congo and UN peacekeepers in the country, we contacted Kambale Musavuli, a Kinshasa-based human rights activist and analyst with the Center for Research on the Congo. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first, tell us, what is the source of the protracted insurgency and violence in the mineral-rich eastern DRC?
It's very important to look at the conflict in the Congo from the context that the war started in 1996. This war in 1996 was a war of invasions for two of Congo's neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda. They invaded the Congo again in 1998. And since the peace accord was signed in 2002, Rwanda and Uganda have been supporting proxy militia groups in the DRC. So when we look at the M23 uprising now, if we do not understand it from the context, we will be confused with Congo having many rebels. Who are these rebels? Who is backing them? But the M23 rebels who have caused the latest havoc in DRC are a proxy militia group of Rwanda who are displacing population, who are killing Congolese people, who are looting resources as well. And it's been documented for the past decade.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has been rocked by protests against the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission. Protesters accused the decades-long UN mission of failing to protect civilians frustrated by an endless cycle of violence.
I came to protest against MONUSCO. It has been years since the mission came to Congo. Many Congolese have been killed in the east.
Are the Congolese people justified in their protests against UN peacekeeping forces?
No, absolutely. I mean, I understand the sentiment of the Congolese population. The Congolese population has watched for almost two decades now the UN forces in the country. The UN came in the Congo in a mission that they call MONUC, which was transformed to MONUSCO. It's a mission to stabilize and bring peace in DRC. We have not had stability, and we have not had peace. And it's a $2 billion budget project in the DRC the UN mission. So when you see how much money is being spent for it, and you see that the intended goal is not happening, that every week we have reports of killing, especially in the east, in different areas, it is normal to actually see the Congolese actually upset about the situation.
The UN first deployed an observer mission to Eastern Congo in 1999. After a decade in 2010, became MONUSCO, the United Nations Organization of Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. MONUSCO was mandated to conduct offensive operations against insurgents and armed groups. Many Congolese now believe that MONUSCO has forgotten its mandate and are now demanding that the UN troops must leave.
We want to see how to remove MONUSCO from our area because they seem to have forgotten that their mandate in Congo is to protect us.
MONUSCO has a current strength of about 16,300 uniformed personnel, making it the world's largest UN mission. However, despite its strength, this United Nations peacekeeping force with an annual budget of around $1 billion has failed to restore peace and protect civilians in the region.
The problem in the Congo, the conflict in the Congo, is a political problem. It cannot be solved by military means. And Patrick Kammert, a former UN commander in the DRC, said it very clearly, that you can put military pressure to bring an end to the conflict, but as long as there is no aggressive diplomacy, there is no pressure on negative forces that are known, those who are fighting with the guns on the ground will feel that they can continue to commit crimes. So this is what we think will help in the DRC to bring about the end, to make sure that the UN forces are effective. We need aggressive diplomacy in putting pressure on negative forces against the Congo, in this case, Rwanda and Uganda. And then we'll see actually the mission be successful at what they were sent there to do. If that does not happen, we'll continue to see UN forces observing the killing of the population. That's been one of the frustrations of the Congolese people.
Celestine Mbala, head of the Congolese Armed Forces, told the regional commanders that the process of setting up a sub-regional force to combat the negative forces should be initiated immediately. He added that all foreign fighters in the country must also leave.
Que tous les groupes armés étrangers actifs en République démocratique du Congo.
All foreign armed groups active in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, are to be disarmed and returned immediately and unconditionally to their respective countries of origin. Otherwise, they will also be considered as negative forces and be subject to military action by the sub-region East Africa Community.
Now, can the Kinshasa government restore peace in the region with the assistance of regional forces?
As far as we know, Uganda will still be part of that mission. The Congolese government has shared a strong reservation of having Rwandan forces in that group. So we don't think, I personally do not think, at the Center for Research of the Congo, we do not believe that a regional force will bring about peace and stability. What we believe will bring about peace and stability is the implementation of the recommendation of the UN Mapping Exercise Report. And what are these recommendations? One, particularly that the Congolese people support, is the creation of an international tribunal for Congo. The reason why it's important, as Dr. Mukwege stated, the Congolese Nobel Peace Prize winner, Dr. Mukwege said that the crimes of yesterday are going to continue until we send a strong message to the criminals on the ground that if you kill the Congolese, you will be tried and there will be justice for the victims. So since 1996, we have not had this process. And why does it have to be an international tribunal? It's because some of the perpetrators of these crimes are not Congolese. So they cannot easily be brought to justice in the DRC if there is not an international framework or training them. So to end the conflict, to end the killing in DRC, we need justice. the justice will come through a tribunal, an international tribunal, and making sure that takes place will change the dynamics in the DRC and in the Great Lakes region.
It is quite clear that if regional countries do not take the initiative to restore peace in the Democratic Republic of Congo, then extra-regional imperialist powers will get a pretext to continue their intervention and further plunder this mineral-rich country.
And now my final question. What role can regional blocs play in bringing peace to the troubled eastern DR Congo?
I think that regional blocs, particularly SADC, the East African community, should also play aggressive diplomacy on destabilizing forces of the Congo so that they do not continue to interfere in Congolese politics. At the level of the African Union, it's the same. We're finding ourselves with the African Union being silent on the situation in the Congo and still loud on the situation in Ukraine. One will ask, why isn't the African Union engaging constructively for peace and stability? The framework that they created for peace and stability in the Congo is to have Angolan president play the role of a mediator between Congo and Rwanda. But the situation is not necessarily around mediation. No, it's a continuous destabilization of DRC. So the African Union also has to engage.
Well, there you have it. The conflict in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo can only be solved through diplomatic initiatives by African countries and the African Union in particular. I'd like to thank our guest, Kambale Musavuli, for his incisive analysis today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Bye for now.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though...
Ya ilaha kull shay'in wa malika ya rabba.
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
Ya khaliqa kull shay'in wa waritha.
So, dear listeners, we are talking about two things that can help us on our path to strengthen and increase and really level up our ubudiyah, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah. Now, the first thing, of course, keeping in mind that there are many, many things that we can do in order to increase and strengthen our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah, but there are two special things that I would like to focus on and pay a little bit of special attention to in this program. Now, the first of those two things is this idea that in one's ubudiyah, in one's servitude and obedience to Allah, in this path of trying to reach Almighty Allah, one has to be constantly alert and be very, very careful. one must pay attention to the kind of different things that happen on this path to increasing and strengthening our ubudiyya, our worship and our servitude and our obedience to Allah. Because, of course, the closer we become to Allah, the more the instigations of Satan come into play. And that is because the last thing that Satan wants is for one to become close to the Almighty Allah. And so this is why the spiritual masters, the masters who have experience on this road to ubudiyya, this road to the servitude of Allah, they say that one must be very careful, one must pay attention, and make sure that you are paying attention to the detail, what you are eating physically and spiritually. Are you reciting the Quran? Are you reciting du'as? Are you going to the masjid, going to the mosque for either congregational prayers or some sort of speeches or sermons? Are you praying the salah? Are you praying the five daily prayers? And what are your actions like? These are all things then one must pay attention to. What are we saying? What are we doing? What are we listening to? What are we watching? Because all of these different things that we listed, and there are more things as well, that affect our spirituality and they affect our ubudiyya. And so regardless of religious branch or method of traveling on this road, you know, to ubudiyya and the ultimate perfect servitude, obedience and worship to Allah, we have to be alert and we have to be careful. In some places, this carefulness is given the similitude of a kind doctor, a compassionate doctor who takes care of their patient and is always watching, you know, making sure, monitoring, everything is okay, there's no problems, blood pressure and, I don't know, cholesterol and these kind of things. And so likewise, the person who is on this road to ubudiyya needs to take care of what they're doing, their actions, their thoughts, the inputs into their soul, which is the eyes and the ears and the tongue, and make sure to look for faults in conduct and then try to fix them. And of course, thank Allah for anything that comes out which is good from an individual.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Brother Nu'man Ali Khan.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Fadallahuma bighurur. Rabbi ishrah li sadri wa yassir li amri wahlul 'uqdatam min lisani yafqahu qawli. The 22nd ayah of Surah Al-A'raf is a long one, but in this brief reminder I want to share with you the first part of the expression that's used in it that has just an incredible amount of wisdom for life, in our dealings with shaitan. Allah Azza wa Jalla is describing how shaitan got our parents, Adam and Hawa, salamun alayhima, to make the mistake that they made. What was his strategy to get them to listen to him? Not just what he said to them. We all know that he whispered to them. We all know that he offered them eternity and that they could stay in Jannah. We know that.
But how did he do it? What method did he use? That method is important to understand, and it's captured in the first expression of the ayah, فَدَلَّهُمَا بِغُرُورٍ. He, dalla is used when you draw a bucket. Like dalw in Arabic is a bucket. And adla is to drop a bucket down and pull it right back up. You know, in the old times there's a well and you kind of crank up the water, you know, and you pull the bucket back up. This is adla. But dalla is to slowly lower the bucket, or to put a bucket, you know, for a very primitive way of hunting an animal. You have some food, like a carrot or something, you put it inside a bucket and it's tied to a rope, and the animal comes and you kind of pull it little by little by little by little towards yourself, and the animal follows it. This is actually called dalla. Like literally, shaitan didn't go out and say, disobey Allah. He offered it a little bit, just a small little bit of compromise, and they listened. And then he offered just a little bit more. It's harmless. What I'm saying isn't haram. I'm just saying, just don't take it a little bit easy, you know. And then you don't have to eat from this tree, in the case of our parents. You don't have to eat from. I'm not saying you should eat from the tree. I'm just saying at least check it out. It's a beautiful tree. There's no harm looking at it, is there? Now, look, Allah's commandment was, وَلَا تَقْرَبَ هَذِهِ الشَّجَرَةِ. Don't go near this tree. So the first thing he says, look, at least you're not touching it. Okay? At least you're not touching it. Just go near it. What's the big deal? And then when they go near, then you know what? It's not like you're not supposed to climb it. You're just not supposed to eat from it. Just have a little climb. It's no big deal. And it's not at one time. Dalla also suggests that these suggestions came a day, then another day, then another day, then another day. Like this was a process for this guy. It wasn't like they did. He whispered to Adam alayhi salam and immediately he went and ate from the tree. There's actually an entire strategic, little by little by little, winning over the argument that he's doing. فَدَلَّهُمَا بِغُرُورٍ. And that's what he does to us to this day. This is the reason it's mentioned in the Quran. That he drew them out with using this. And the بِغُرُورَ, I didn't translate, using deception. This is a kind of deception. In other words, there are things that are clearly wrong. You and I know that. There are things that are clearly, clearly wrong. But there are a lot of small, not as clearly wrong steps that are there that you should have the sense to know, if I take this one tiny step, tomorrow I'll be taking another tiny step, and then another, and then another, and before I know it, I'll end up in the wrong. So you have to put protective measures in place. And when you put those protective measures in place, it keeps you from falling into trouble. Now shaitan comes and he talks, he doesn't attack or he doesn't tell you to make the haram into halal. Oh, that's too direct. And the Muslim will say, no, it's obviously haram. I'm not going to do that. He comes and he says, listen, this one little step I'm asking you to take, it's clearly not haram. That's not wrong. You could do that much at least. There's nobody that can blame you for that. And then people come and say to the scholar, to the alim, to the da'i, to the khatib, hey, so I know that doing, you know, drinking is wrong, but can I hang out with friends who drink? I mean, I'm not going to the bar or anything, but sometimes they drink in my office. Can I just be with them? Just, you know, because, you know, they're my friends. Can I at least do that much? Is it absolutely haram for me to do that? And the scholar will say something like, you know, I advise you not to do it. It's not a good idea. It's bad company. But is it haram? Is it absolutely haram? And he says, well, I don't know if I could say it's okay, thanks, I got my answer. It's not absolutely haram, which means I could do it. And that's how shaitan gets you to first hang out with them. Then they say, hey, we're going to the bar, you want to come along? Then you go to the bar and you're just having a Coke or whatever and they're drinking their beer. And then eventually one late night, you know, it's a little bit of a, can you just slip some in? You know, somebody gave it to you or they slipped it into your drink and you didn't realize. And you're like, well, I didn't intend to do it. And it's just one thing after another, after another, after another. SubhanAllah. This is فَدَلَّهُمَا بِغُرُورٍ. This is the same surah in which Allah mentions the story of Barsisa, who went little by little by little into sin. You know, and this is not the occasion to tell you that story, but the point is the same. Shaitan will not come at you directly calling you to do the wrong thing. Shaitan will come at you to try to just compromise or get on the road to the wrong. And by the way, when you're on that road, until you do the wrong, nobody can come out and directly tell you, listen, by the way, this is wrong what you're doing. Because it's not wrong. It's on the road to it. And if you don't recognize that you're being pulled slowly but surely towards it, then you only have yourself to blame. This is why Allah's commandment to Adam alayhi salam, the advice to Adam alayhi salam, wasn't just don't eat from this tree. The advice was don't go near it. There's a big difference between those two things, you know? And so you and I have to recognize there are some things that are clearly haram, but there's a road that leads to them. We have to watch out and not go on that track that shaitan's trying to reel us into. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website, www.parstoday.com.
Welcome back, dear listeners. In continuation to what we were saying, which was this idea that on the path to the ultimate perfection of the ubudiyya, the servitude and the obedience and the worship to Allah, is this idea that we must pay attention to, we must be careful, and we must be alert when it comes to many different things, such as praying the salah, reciting the Holy Quran, and the reciting of du'as, and of course our actions and what we say, what we hear, what we see, how we act, what our thoughts are, you know, when it comes to, for example, anger or showing off, riya, or greediness or jealousy or all these kind of things, pride, arrogance. We must be very careful, we must be alert, because as we said in the previous segment, the closer that an individual becomes to Allah and the purer and more sincere that their ubudiyya to Allah becomes, the more the insinuations and instigations and attacks of shaitan will come towards us. And so in order to prevent the, or at least defend ourselves from the attacks of shaitan, we must do our best to pay attention to what is going on with ourselves. The example that we gave was like a compassionate doctor, a kind doctor, who is always monitoring the patient to make sure that they heal and recover fully. Now, the second thing which is of great importance, of course, from among the many great things that are important when it comes to strengthening our ubudiyya, the second thing is that we must never neglect seeking refuge and protection and help in the sacred essence of Allah, the glorified, the Most High. Seeking help from Allah on this path in order to increase and strengthen and level up and brighten and illuminate our ubudiyya is something that can never be forgotten. For of course it is Allah, the mighty, the wise, the kind, the merciful, the most quick to forgive. It is Allah who is the one who gives us the tawfiq and the grace and the permission and the strength and the power and the purity to be able to conduct an ubudiyya, an obedience, a servitude, a worship of Allah that is acceptable to Allah. Now, of course, we do understand that any level of ubudiyya is still not enough when we see how much it is that Allah the Almighty deserves. But still, that much that we can do to the greatest of our extent should be as perfect as we can make it. Now, on the average and on the ordinary, we know that this journey towards the perfection of ubudiyya can take ages, meaning it can very well take a whole lifetime. And usually, on the average, it does take people a whole lifetime. And of course, it takes time to be able to reform and perfect the self in order to attain an ubudiyya, which inshallah is acceptable to Allah. And in this lifetime that we are trying to accomplish this, of course, paying very careful attention to what we do and reforming the wrong and correcting and increasing the right and seeking help in the Almighty Allah are two things that will help us to increase, strengthen, and level up our servitude, our obedience, our worship to Allah, our ubudiyya to Allah.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. لا إله سواه لا تخالطه الظنون ولا العيون تراه الله جل في علاه هو أنسي وملاذي أحتمي بحماه حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is for a better life. For a better life.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners, sisters and brothers. This is Arab English Radio. Once more, I have the honor to be here with you. You're listening to Asma. And here we talk basically some literary stuffs related to Ashura and the Battle of Karbala. Previously, we talked about literature of Ashura. We said that it's got different forms of poetry and prose, elegy, dirge, sermon, lament. And as for prose, we have short stories, novels, and of course, the ziyarats through which we talk to Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. Well, on preceding sessions, I mainly talked about the thematical subjects of the literary pieces that are involved with the Battle of Karbala and the tragical story behind it, the most prominent of which were pure devotion, reckless loyalty, and most importantly, love, and also a precise account of what happened in the battlefield, of course, behind the tent of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Now let's talk about the mission of the poet or the writer as the one who's taking us through this journey. The writer's task is to take us to that exact field through the spiritual wings of imagination to an extent that we as audience no longer feel any barrier, any curtain, any distance. We come to feel as the witness who is going through the same agony, a sort of a spiritual anguish. Will fill our heart, and in that very moment of true love, we feel that this journey is just taking us through the exact same thing that the goal of this story, this tragic story is. We talked about this very fact right now. We said that it's going to be a spiritual anguish. Our heart is going to be filled with it. The kind of love that is going to be raised in here is the sort of pure love that we feel toward our beloved Imam. We full-heartedly wish that we were with him and accompanied him with every essence of our existence. With that emotional outburst, we start to think and ask questions. If I could have had a chance to pick a side and join the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam as the manifestation of truth, would I really say yes? Would it be easy for me to pick the right side and see the light? Well, now, before we answer this question, let's go for a short break. Then we'll be back in a blink of an eye to share our answers. Thank you for listening.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
You're listening to For a Better Life. I asked you a question just right now. I said that, is it going to be easy to pick sides considering the situation that happened in the field of Karbala? The answer is actually very difficult. It's always easier said than done. That's why we have to keep our hearts pure and never let the corruption to get into the core of our heart. To have a strong connection with Allah, the only Almighty of the world, and the one who created us, sent us down to the world, fed us with his kindness, and helped us to survive all the difficulties and bloom like a flower through years. So just like Imam Hussein alayhi salam puts it in a poem he murmured at the night of Ashura, and I'm going to read it right now for you. It says, O life, how many friends have you in the morning that you leave them dead in the evening? The alternatives would never satisfy you. Every living being has got a path to take. So close is everyone's time to leave. And everything is up to God. Only He remains forever. So as you can see in here, it has been mentioned that life is very short and temporary and everyone has got a journey. And once that journey is finished, we have to leave. And the time of departure is usually very close to us. It's not just like you're going to leave forever and we are not immortals. As I just said, there is an inevitable truth, and it's the death. Everyone will die sooner or later. The only thing that gives a value to our death is the cause that we have lived for. So if we recognize the delicate string between haq and batil, so to speak, the good and evil, in every aspect of our life, we try to pick the right. Only in this case we could claim that we might see the light even in the darkest hours, and we could be considered as the army to our hidden Imam, just like the army of his grandfather, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Now, this is not an easy task. Just as I mentioned right in here, through this poem and the entire sessions that we're having in this part of For a Better Life, it's going to be a difficult, and I shall call it a drudgery, a difficult task and a drudgery. It would be for one to keep their heart pure. But that is the aim of our living, the aim of our existence, why we are living in this world, why we are going through this much of difficulties. It's just because we have to elevate ourselves. It's because we have to get closer to the sublime, to have a link with it, to never forget that this life is very short. Whatever happens to us is temporary, and nothing is going to last forever. It's not very easy to say that the people who picked the wrong side in the Battle of Karbala were all blind, or they did not see the truth in front of them. Perhaps some of them saw the truth, but they couldn't admit it. They could not confess the truth. Because, you know, to see the truth, to recognize it is something, and to claim it in a crowd is another totally different story. So the only thing that we could do in order to just help ourselves know that we are going to stay firmly according to what we believe, what we have faith in, is the fact that we should practice. There must be so much of practice in all parts of our life in which we have to just recognize the truth. We have to keep our heart pure and go exactly according to our faith. And, you know, it's just like our soul is just like a tree. We have to water it with our faith, with that link and connection that we keep pure with Allah. And to always have this sight in our heart that the curtains will never stay forever like this. One day they're going to fall down and everything is going to be clear. And in that very exact time when the curtains fall, the ones who have done their best to stay pure and loyal are going to be the winners of the whole story of life, and they're going to be the hero of their stories. It's not easy to say that, yes, for sure, I would have picked the right side with Imam Hussein alayhi salam. It's not just like that. It's not so easy. We have to practice so much. We have to maintain the purity of our heart. We have to give a special shape to our soul and help it grow and get closer to the sublime that is Allah the Almighty. I hope you enjoyed today's session. And until another program for a better life, I bid you farewell. May Allah bless you. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, He knows.
The Limelight.
Fox News anchor Eric Shawn floated the possibility that former President Donald Trump may have tried to sell classified documents to Russia or to Saudi Arabia. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Jason Lemon. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Fox News host floats possibility Trump tried to sell classified documents. Fox News anchor Eric Shawn has floated the possibility that former President Donald Trump may have tried to sell classified documents to Russia or to Saudi Arabia. The FBI executed a search warrant at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort residence on Monday, 8th of August, in search of top-secret and sensitive compartmentalized information, as well as other classified documents. The Washington Post reported on Thursday, 11th of August, that information regarding nuclear weapons was believed to be among the documents sought by federal agents. And a Russian state television host said officials in Moscow have already studied the records. Donald Trump described the report regarding nuclear weapons documents as a hoax. In a Sunday Fox News broadcast, Eric Shawn interviewed former intelligence officer and Russian expert Rebecca Kofler. At the start of the segment, The Fox News anchor raised questions about what Donald Trump may have done with the classified materials. Eric Schon, citing reports, said that intelligence officials reportedly feared either the material was being mishandled or even possibly illegally transferred to others. And more questions are being raised this morning. Did former President Donald Trump try to sell or share the highly classified material to the Russians or to the Saudis or to others? Or were the documents innocently mishandled and stored because he thought he had a legal right to have them? The Fox News anchor Eric Schon asked. Former intelligence officer and Russian expert Rebecca Kofler weighed in with her perspective, saying that Trump's Florida home as a storage for such documents presents a counterintelligence nightmare. The real question, Eric, is what Russian President Vladimir Putin has already done, Kofler said. The truth is the United States is the top target for KGB and Russia's spy services. Rebecca Kofler added that Mar-a-Lago is a counterintelligence nightmare, meaning that spies from all over the world, Russia, China and beyond, are always on the hunt to lay their hands on top secret information, especially something that is related to nuclear warfare doctrine. The fact that those boxes were not secure is a really grave concern, she said. Meanwhile, Russian media personalities have defended Donald Trump and also said that the classified documents were reviewed by Moscow officials. Last week, during the Russian TV news program 60 Minutes, military expert Igor Kravchenko echoed Donald Trump's assessment of the FBI raid, calling it a witch hunt. Igor Kravchenko said that as the most popular politician in the United States, Donald Trump was chosen as such a witch. They won't just be vilifying him, they'll be strangling him. These raids involving dozens of FBI officers and police dogs, this is a symbol of inordinate despotism, the Russian military expert added. Over the weekend, during a segment on a state-owned Russia One television channel, a host discussed the raid and said Russians had access to the documents seized from Mar-a-Lago in Florida. It turns out that the investigation against Trump has to do with the disappearance of secret documents from the White House related to the development of nuclear weapons by the United States. Host Evgeny Popov said. Popov added, the FBI isn't saying what kinds of weapons or what they found in Donald Trump's state. Obviously, if there were any important documents, they've been studying them in Moscow for a while. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has rejected reporting that there was information about nuclear weapons held at his Florida residence, Mar-a-Lago. Nuclear weapons issue is a hoax, just like Russia was a hoax. Two impeachments were a hoax. The Mueller investigation was a hoax, and much more. Same sleazy people involved, the former president wrote in a post on his Truth Social platform early on Friday morning, 12th of August. The former president has described the Justice Department probe and the FBI search of his home in Mar-a-Lago as a scam. Like all of the other hoaxes and scams that they've used to try and silence the voice of a vast majority of the American people, I have truth on my side. And when you have truth, you will ultimately be victorious, he wrote on Saturday on Truth Social. Newsweek has reached out to Donald Trump's press office for comment.
questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much, and to you too.
Dear listeners, Brother Miqdad is Islamic researcher and teacher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. It's a pleasure to be with you, as always. Brother Miqdad, I won't name the state, but some time ago, I was at a place and I went to the parlor where I saw a female who was not like looking very normal in physically, and as if she was looking exactly like a Barbie doll, as if taken out of the television and put down on the floor. So I was amazed on her looks and everyone who would come in and would look at her. And then someone asked her, "How did you do that?" And the amount that she mentioned for slimming her body, I was like amazed. And then, you know, I couldn't, was how much, like, I thought over it so much. How can a person spend so much just to look slim? But this trend seems to be, you know, going on. And, you know, every young girl who was coming into that parlor was kind of getting attracted, or like I may say, they were kind of telling her, what is the rate, we would want to go, which doctors and stuff. So don't you think this trend has become really like so much normal, and girls today are so much connected about this thing, they are like so much concerned, sometimes looking just thin and sometimes even abnormally thin. What do you say about that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The discussion of body image today and the impact that this concept has on self-esteem as well as mental health in teenagers is something very, very important that needs to be discussed, especially in Islamic families and Muslim families. You see, if you look at the research out there, now this is research, academic research in the Western world, you find that, for instance, research suggests that above more than 40% of adverts use beauty and body image as product appeal. You find that, and very interestingly, what happens is that this concept of beauty, what it does is that it portrays a body image out there, telling the youth today that this is the true beauty. This body image that you see on TV, which is glamorous, which is given so much importance, which is highlighted as a perfection, is that which will bring you happiness, that which will give you value. If you reach this type of body, then you will actually be valuable, respected, important. You will gain this self-esteem. Mm-hmm. So this is on one side. And on the other side, again, research suggests that there's only 1% there's only 1% chance to be as thin as a supermodel.
Okay.
So on the other side, girls have been given a target that is pretty much impossible for 99% of girls out there to reach. And so this leads to dissatisfaction with their bodies, and it leads to all sorts of mental health.